the first time I paid someone to change the oil on my vehicle, I seriously, I don't know if I slept that night. I had such, like, I don't know, I guess maybe insecurities around, am I going to be disavowed? Am I less of a man? Welcome to the Ranch Investor Podcast. I am Coulter DeVries, your three-year host. I'm an accredited land consultant with the Realtor Land Institute and an accredited farm manager with ASFMRA, American Society of Farm Managers and Rural Appraisers.
The Ranch Investor Podcast is the most downloaded and informative industry-specific content that intrigues while entertains.
Before we get started, as usual, I'd love to hear your feedback. So if you have a recommended guest or a subject, please let me know. We're back.
I'm back. It's been a while.
It has been. What have you been up to?
Developing my business, developing my team, deep into team development, basically, which is pretty exciting. Traveling some.
Is it hard to keep up with the Montana ranch market right now?
You know, it kind of felt this week, maybe it's just because I was back in town. You know, generally, no, it's been pretty slow. Been pretty, last week was pretty slow, but I was doing some catch up today and thinking, boy, it feels like things are maybe heating up, but I'm on the site right now, 357 listings. That's right where we've been all year since summer.
Headed into the Christmas break.
Yeah.
And normally we do have a lull, a winter freeze.
Yeah, although sometimes, they're depending on like the year, sometimes there's a little spike, like regime change. If a new presidency's coming in.
The bullshit. Oh, I'll just wait and see what happens with the election.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So buyers and sellers both.
And there have been times over time where there's either an actual or perceived like taxation change, right? Like change in the state.
Threat of 1031
capital gain,
reform.
Capital gains. So sometimes you see motivation at the end of the year. I don't think there's anything this year doing that.
Well, I like to tell people in passing at the grocery store who ask me, what's it like? What's the ranch market doing? How's business? I say, I'm no longer competing with other brokers. I'm competing with the banks. So the banks offering, 5.5% risk-free. More people seem inclined to put that money, whether it's cash, you know, or capitalizing on stocks, put that into CDs. And at 5.5% risk-free, that is what your annualized return historically is on ranches, and those are not risk-free.
So alternative investments competing with real estate.
Yeah, well, not alternative. It's just the cost of capital. The you know, if you're going to get 2% on an annual yield, which is best case scenario, and then 4% appreciation annualized, there's your 6% annual return. You could, if you think in the slightest way that this market is top heavy, that you're, as Andy Ron says, our guest today, as he says, if you're prepaying inflation, if you're buying in appreciation, then yeah, you're going to be inclined to just go CDs today. And I say, I'm competing with those damn bankers.
I don't see any deals out there. I don't see any low-hanging fruit in the ranch investment market right now.
I made an offer on one.
Yeah?
Personally.
Really?
Yeah, for the online syndication.
Uh-huh.
So I figured this one's been on the market a while. It's got some hair on it. And so it missed the best market in history. It's been out there over 2 years. And I was like, oh, even though they haven't done a price reduction, which is a red flag, I was like, well, it's worth taking a shot. I mean, it's my own time in writing up this offer, and I need to load it with contingencies for online syndication, because I still got to register the offering with the SEC and write up the PPM. And then
that is to say, have a legal entity that can buy something?
Well, I've got all the back end is completely formed. I've got the infrastructure built, even the back office for fund management for K-1s. Even the accreditation process, the approval process, the escrow funding, all the entire infrastructure is built. It's finding a decent product to offer. And I thought this one was worth my time. And they just flat out rejected it, ghosted me. It was like, I felt like I was in the dating pool again. and my swipe left went nowhere.
Didn't even respond.
Was it
a real, real low ball or?
No, I actually wrote it what I thought was 5 to 10% higher than anyone else in the market.
Wow.
Because I was like, if I'm going to ask for all of these contingencies, they're going to want to see what's in it for me. And so.
So you did, it is an unusual level of contingencies,
absolutely.
Standard. Okay.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And one with hair on it that missed the best market in history. Why not take a shot at that one?
I wonder if the seller has that perspective on their listing.
Well, in that. So even the listing broker, which I'm not going to name names, they ghosted me. And I
we should have extra content for pay. We should have a next hour and share all the names.
Patreon account for getting the real dirt.
You got to go to the dark web to see it.
If you want the real dirt.
This is the kind of thing we dream about.
Yeah. Although then, launch into a tangent, then I feel like we might be abusing that privilege, that power, and going on a canceling campaign, just out there, just canceling people left and right.
That's the problem. It's hard to cancel people in our industry.
Exactly. Yes. Very.
No for one, better, for better or worse.
No one wants to put their name on a complaint to the Department of Labor.
Yeah. And what would that do anyway?
Yeah. So I made the offer and I actually gave them a week and a half to consider it because it was loaded with contingencies.
Mm-hmm. Can you share some of those, just broad strokes?
Yeah, one was contingent upon raising. So the ranch, I made an offer of 5.28. And one of the contingencies was contingent upon actually raising 5.5 via online syndication.
I mean, that's a unique funding mechanism, but it's not unusual to have funding in general be a contingency. So that's not too crazy.
That was just a basic financing contingency, essentially.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the way some due diligence, and that is another basic contingency, inspection.
Yeah.
And so I didn't think they were out of line. I did ask for 6 months to put this together. And I gave them a week and a half to consider it. The listing broker ghosted me, didn't even tell me, verbally declined.
So the due diligence is 6 months?
The due diligence was only 3 months.
Okay, that's not...
The financing contingency was 6 months.
Okay, so that's unusual. That's a long time.
Yeah, well, when you're doing something new and different.
Yeah.
Proven the concept, the minimum viable product, the proof of concept beta test here.
But like you said, they missed the market as far as, I mean, the market is, we can get into this, you know, it varies by property type and whatever, but the market is at the least flat, if not declining.
On most properties, what about the trophy properties?
Yeah, that's a different story.
Yeah. This is not a trophy property.
Does the seller know that?
In their mind, it's probably got gold and lithium underneath of it.
Surely their listing broker didn't take out enough ads in the Wall Street Journal. That's why it didn't sell.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and I mean, I have my opinions of his performance in customer service as well. And I'm shouldn't be critiquing my peers, my competition. That's not professional, but I don't ghost anyone. And at the very minimum, I've never done this, but at the very minimum, you can at least send someone a text and say verbally declined.
Yeah.
So I had to follow up and try to get a hold of the listing broker.
I feel like you're going to slip. <Just kidding. laughs> There is editing available.
Yeah, that's right. Ray, pay close attention.
Is it going to be a beep or is it just going to?
Just to cut it out. And so this one actually did check some of the boxes. Location, elk, scenery. That's pretty much it. And there was, value add. There's a play for value add that I could see. I know the neighbors. I know the area. It's my home area. So, you know, I felt like I had a competitive and comparative advantage there to come in, step in, and add value to the place. Well, if you get it bought at the right price.
Right.
And so, no, they, you ask about, does the seller know that it's not a trophy property? When they ghosted me, and then finally, after like 8 missed calls over days, it took probably 2.5 weeks to hear back from the listing broker. I did get a text. Oh, sorry. Super busy. They said the price was too low.
Super busy not selling anything.
Yeah. Yep.
And super busy in this volume.
Yeah.
Deprived.
Yeah. Don't bullshit a bullshitter telling me you're super busy. I know otherwise.
Right.
And so I wanted to be like, well, Mr. Broker, I wanted to say this over the phone, text message. I just said, okay, thanks. But I wanted to be like, okay, I think what the situation is either your seller is shit, your listing is shit, or you're doing a shit job. Pick two of them.
It's got to be 2 out of 3 at least. Yeah, it never ceases to amaze me, the lack of professionalism, actually. You know, I mean, I tell people, just like a lot of industries, you know, 20%, 80% of the work's done by 20% of the people. I think it might be more like 90-10 in real estate.
Absolutely. And I look back on the craziness of 2020 and 2021, and I know that I wasn't perfect with customer service and professionalism. And mm-hmm. I think there are protocols and expected professionalism that I probably fell short in a lot of ways, but it was crazy back then.
Right.
Crazy on my end, crazy buyers. I had a lot of preppers and a lot of tire kickers, disingenuous people watching the TV series Yellowstone. I shouldn't create excuses. I do know that during the craziness, the frenzy, that I wasn't perfect by any means. But today, I think today's a really good opportunity to be as professional.
Tighten things up a little bit. Well, you know, I mean, I spend an inordinate amount of time Montana Land Source, and you know, that's the value proposition. You know, we track stuff down. We check everything. You know, my data on Montana Land Source is not broker managed, which I think sets me apart from any other site.
You can't
site.
Be influenced.
Yeah, any other site you go to. And so an inordinate amount of time tracking stuff down, just lots of time. And the hell of it is you know, probably at least 60%, maybe knocking on 70% of the brokers out there are crap. So, you know, it's just dealing with legitimately unprofessional people. Then you get into the true professionals, and the reality is a lot of them are really busy and really struggle to, right? The producers legitimately struggle with, you know, busyness. And I'm always not, I feel like I've got great, you know, relationships and people wanting to talk to me and stuff, but you know, I'm not a cash buyer either. Right. So those hot times, right. They're hopping, actually selling stuff and making money. And I don't represent that. I'm more like a long-term, you know, relationship kind of thing. But so between busy guys, between the ones that are super busy and hard to get a hold of, and the ones that think they're busy, or I don't know what they think, but they just suck.
I'd like to see a case study between volume brokerages that have lots and lots of listings, volume dealers versus the bespoke boutique type. So in small independent offices, maybe one man shows like myself.
Well,
I'd like to see a case study done on customer service, and
I'm not going to mention
the difference there.
I'm not going to mention names. I'm not going to mention a name either, but
there's several volume dealers.
Well, I just noticed this actually recently. I hadn't really thought about it.
And there's even more
it.
Independent guys.
Yeah,
with
yeah.
Shitty customer service.
Yeah. But there's an outfit that was the volume dealer, I would say, in Montana for years. And they clearly had a model. They'd take any listing, I think, under almost any circumstances. They just, you know, that was their business model. More of a volume, and you know, certain percentage is gonna hit. So that was their model. And they dominated volume across the state, and they've almost disappeared. Their volume has gone way down. I don't know what's happened.
Ebbs and flows.
Yeah, I don't think it's really the market as much as I'm just guessing some kind of internal shift with that firm. I would guess. I don't really know.
Change of leadership and strategy, or
that's kind of what I suspect.
Working the CRM,
like the founders, you know, have kind of moved on, or I don't know, something. I don't know, but I just noticed that the other day. It's like, all right, that outfit used to dominate volume, but you could predict a hyper, to your point about, you know, data or stats on that. They had a high amount, they had a high volume, but they had a high fallout rate, right? So a high percentage of what they took on didn't end up selling.
And that is expensive when you're just, right? Your overheads, you need the transactions to first reach your break even. And right, when you're taking on listings that aren't bringing in the income and you have that high marketing budget, that's fixed cost for a lot of us.
Well, and you know, another thing I'll share, actually my business is down a little bit for the first time. I've always, I'd say rate of growth is down. I've always been growing, but my rate of growth is down. And I think it's, there's been a handful of one-off guys and retirements, kind of I might categorize as semi-early, or right?
It's, yeah, like, they got a big win, and
this is a good time to
they're get going out. Barry Sanders, yeah, going out.
Although,
on top.
One great client, and I love my good clients. I mean, some of these guys call and they're just as apologetic as hell. You know, just like, Andy, I'm so sorry, blah blah. It's like, hey man, you know, you're retiring, you're moving on, you're cutting expenses, right? I get it. I can be cheap, you know. I don't. But one guy basically was like, yeah, you know, I think I'm kind of out. Think I'm kind of retiring, and can I pull the plug? Of course, I said yes. But then a couple months later, he's like, God, you know, got a little deal flow kicking up, so I need you back.
Yeah.
And he was apologetic then too. It's like, hey, that's why I got month to month subscriptions. Jump on, jump off every other month if you want. I'm good with that, you know.
Well, as we enter the Christmas break here, and we've been talking about the difference between trophy ranches and how there is a plateauing of seemingly everything else, what's going on with the trophy ranches? There are some big listings that hit the market week by week, and they do sell.
Yeah, there's been some big sales. I mean, CA is
privately.
Yeah.
That was like a consolidation of a prior syndication.
Yeah. So it was a sale resale. You know, the whole place sold, of course, just a few years ago. And that was a record breaking. And then it was the main unit, because it had multiple units. So it's the main unit that just resold. And, you know, we can't share percentages. And honestly, well, you threw out appreciation rate yourself that you would determine on that, but what'd you say, 30%?
Yeah, 30 or even a little more
in 2 years.
2 years, yeah.
Yeah, so that does not represent the bulk of the market, I would say, in any way. But we seem to see these, because you know that it's just a highly unique, you know, there's only a few of those.
Yeah, you can't normalize that.
Right.
And I would say something like that, 30% annualized return on 2 years is more of like an opportunistic flip. Mm-hmm. It's not an annualized ride the appreciation.
Right, right.
That was a very, very unique property that,
yeah,
it's like a Monet. We've said it before.
Kind of a once in a lifetime. You know, these properties are kind of once in a lifetime. Well,
right. Yeah.
Until 2 years go by. Once in a lifetime every 2 years.
Especially for these old guys buying them, it's definitely once in a lifetime.
Yeah, right. Like Murdoch, what was he knocking on, 80 years old when, yep, he bought? Yeah, in Southwest Montana. I mean,
speaking of syndication, I see that a Frank Lloyd Wright, you know, the architect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's known for, what is it, modernism?
Yeah, I think something like that, right? A very modern,
contemporary modernism, or his own style. Yeah. You know, it's Frank Lloyd Wright style.
Yeah, he defined a style.
Yeah, so there's a Frank Lloyd Wright house not selling on the market, and for what, you know, what the seller's asking, and I see in an article that they are going to fractionalize it. And wow, they're going to syndicate it. They have six units. So you buy a unit in an SPV, special purpose vehicle, the LLC that owns the house.
So you're buying a sixth. You're buying, yep, a sixth of a house.
Yep.
So it's going to be like a like a Frank Lloyd Wright timeshare.
Well, it is. Picasso has the same model. Picasso, one of the former founders of Zillow, started Picasso, and that's 1/8 interest in a second home or a vacation home. Mm. And when they started, the minimum was $350,000, but they also ran into low supply as I'm struggling with low options, low inventory. And now the minimum, I don't know where it's at, 450, 500,000, if you want a 1/8 interest in a home. And it is, you pick the home that you're going to be buying into, the LLC, the SPV. So it's Malibu, Aspen, Ibiza, London, whatever. And that's what this seller is trying to do. They're saying, well, we can't get our price from one buyer. Let's fractionalize it for a higher value.
I mean, haven't timeshares kind of become a joke of an investment, right? Aren't they the case study for a bad way to spend your money?
I mean, you'd think so. I've never looked into it because there is so much negativity around them.
Well, there's ads for multiple companies for getting you out of your timeshare.
Because, like, it's a contract. You're actually buying a property, right? Did you know that? You have a right to time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would figure so.
So you have an interest, a title. You have an interest on the real property in a timeshare. Right. So their rules or regulations are so much different because you have to be licensed to sell timeshares specifically.
Right. That sounds familiar.
And that's probably because, you know, so many people got fleeced.
Right. Regulation. Let's just create a special certification for this sector.
Yeah. I've never looked into it. I don't know of a timeshare. I'm sure there are some in Montana. Big Sky.
Well, yeah. What's kind of coming up for me, and I was actually talking to an appraiser recently about this, you know, for a while, especially, I guess it started up maybe 20 years ago. Sort of a fractional, it wasn't really kind of a fractionalized interest, you know, these ranch developments where you have your home site, but then you're kind of shared communal.
Common area.
Yeah.
Common area maintenance. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And those largely failed, I would say. There was a few high profile ones that dramatically failed. And then even the ones that were successful, like, well, kind of Big Sky, like Yellowstone Club, kind of was an early model there. You know, same idea, because you have your condo or whatever, but you're part of a shared overall, the lodge and all this kind of stuff. But one of the arguments made on those markets, and then Foley, who did Rock Creek Ranch, kind of a similar deal, kind of a shared amenity.
Yep.
But one of the arguments is, you know, do those guys have their own community of buyers because of who they are? And they can just pick up the phone and say, hey, I think you should consider this, and right?
Yeah.
It's not exactly an open market.
Right. It's pretty limited and exclusive to their group of friends and individuals.
Well, and this is, I'd interest to hear your response to this with your syndication strategy. You know, one thing kind of inherent forever in owning Montana land is not being in bed with anybody if you can help it. I mean, that's kind of the mystique. Is what's the joke? You know, you can shoot or take a leak off your deck.
Yeah.
Right. So shared ownership of any kind of goes counter somewhat to what's been the sort of culture behind.
For sure.
How does your model address that get out from that?
Yeah, I was looking at the livestock value of a ranch. So grazing income, fee income.
$25 an acre?
Well, like less than that. But roughly, if you capitalized it, it seemed like, depending on the trophy ranch location, 15% of the value. And as you go east to Montana, or eastern Montana, northern Great Plains, eastern Colorado, whatever it might be.
A little higher.
30%. So 30% of the value is derived from grazing, from agriculture. So now you're looking at 60 to 85% is something else: location, exclusivity, privacy, rights, full control, recreation, and so it's
bragging rights.
Absolutely. So what is the value in democratizing, fractionalizing that other 80% of the value? Would that deteriorate the market value to each one limited partner, each one unit in the SPV. I mean, it's being tested with Picasso and the Frank Lloyd Wright house and other specialized assets.
And I mean, counter to what I just said about it being part of Montana, I guess if you call it land ownership culture, that, you know, you own it and do whatever the heck control. You want with it. Total control. But on the flip side of that, it's a lot of work and a lot of hassle and a lot of, right? And there's obviously a lot out there about generational shift, like experiences over, you know, outright ownership kind of thing. So then it's like, well, can I have a partial ownership in something? And yes, I have less control, but I also have less risk, less maintenance, hassle, work.
I think that's what's being played out and tested is the generational shift, consumer tastes and preferences. One thing I run into a lot is guys who want to buy a ranch for the hunting, for the elk, and say that they're going to leverage it. And the annual payment is $350,000. Like I had one guy tell me, he goes, Coulter,
that's a pretty expensive elk.
Yeah, exactly. It is. Well, and he said, Coulter, last year I took my family on hunts, guided, outfitted my whole family, Alaska, Northern Canada. My bill for taking my family around the world was $400,000. If I were to get into a ranch where the P&I, if I were to leverage it, no cash out type of a deal, and the P&I was $400,000 a year, I'm stuck to that one ranch.
Right. It's kind of like buying a cabin versus a camper travel trailer.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's pluses and minuses for each. I know with anecdotally, right, my family, my in-laws, their cabin on Holland Lake, that's where all the memories are made.
Right.
They're
right.
Not made in the RV.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's sentimental. It's very, there's feelings around a place, sense of place,
yeah,
sense of community, sense of going back and the memories made. It's personal. It's very subjective. And,
yeah,
you know, it's a ranch isn't for everyone. Guided outfit hunts are not for everyone.
Right.
They're not for me. I prefer jumping in the Ford Raptor with my friends with beer and other things, screaming through the sagebrush, doing 65, chasing down an elk. That I don't want an outfitted guided hunt.
Right, right. You want the redneck, the authentic redneckery.
I don't know about authentic. It just is. It just is.
Yeah. So you got to freshen me up with your fractionalized ownership. Then what are the amenities and the perks that an investor in that
those are gets? Benefits. So those are not rights. As with the timeshare, you're buying rights. Mm-hmm. With when you buy into an SPV, you have investor rights. You don't have real property rights.
And that's what you are marketing both investment. It's an investment and it's also a recreational opportunity.
Yeah, right. I believe personally that it should always be treated as an investment first.
Yeah.
I feel that way about my primary house, my primary dwelling residence.
Well, otherwise, you know, you like we were kind of saying the $400,000, like, you know, throwing money at, I mean, there's only a few people that will just not care what the investment value, right?
Correct.
Basically millions of dollars is what it would take. And just to play, like that's a unique.
That's what we think. And a lot of people, I think, project that onto the wealthy elite that, oh, they've got throwaway money.
Right, right.
It's an asset first. It has to have a compelling reason to take money from somewhere and put it into something. Because,
you know, early
there's opportunity costs.
Yeah, early in my career, I was talking to a buyer, you know, the classic, you know, out of state, very wealthy, out of state buyer bought a place. And I was able to deeply interview him. He was great. He, you know, was happy to really talk to me. And so I really, you know, rolled up the sleeves on it. And he characterized his purchase as 75% recreation, 25% investment. You know, it was the family recreational aspect was you know, he was putting that top on the list and kind of an investment too, right? But after talking to him for a while, that flipped. And he admitted as such. He's like, oh yeah, I'm definitely not losing money on this thing. And he ended up realizing, no, it's an investment that I get some play value out of, recreational value out of. And I assume you're kind of doing the same thing, because I know you and I know, you know, Focus, it's a sophisticated investment.
Has to be.
Vehicle with some recreational
benefits.
Benefits. Yep. Yeah, right? That's yes. The model.
Yeah.
And I know from your marketing and talking to you that making that accessible to people that, like you and I, can't afford to buy our own multi-million-dollar ranch.
Correct.
For that same. We might, if we could afford it, we might do that on our own. But as it is, we would be stuck with a 20-acre in one of those crappy rural subdivisions.
The horse ghettos.
That you do not go to unarmed.
Yeah. 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 If I'm going to take $150,000 and my opportunity is a horse ghetto,
right,
rural subdivision, or a 1/80th interest in a 20,000-acre ranch, you know, yeah, I'd have to cost benefit, and that's apples to oranges, but, you know, find a way to do your debits and credits charts, your pluses and minuses, and see which one works out best.
So here's a question for you. Is part of that recreational opportunity tied to the IAG operation, like, you know, getting to help brand and those kind of things, or is it mostly focused on like hunting?
No, those enterprises are separate leases. And part of the partnership agreement, the private placement memorandum, you, as a limited investor, you have tax benefits. You have your tax at passive investment rates. You cannot influence the decisions or the happenings, the activities around the SPV. So you couldn't approach the manager, me, and say, well, I think we should plant an orchard of apples. Like, you know, this new gene of apples coming along is going to kill it.
I think we should do a conservation easement on this property. I think we should reintroduce.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't influence the manager in any way. Delaware case law, where, so the entities are registered. It's Ranch Investor One LLC is the SPV that is registered in Delaware. Delaware case law states that you can't sue the manager for mismanagement. You can't sue them for poor performance. I want my money back. If you had any part in influencing the outcome of the economics and finances of that SPV. So you also can't go to the tenant and say, why don't you let me ride with you? Because, you know, things happen.
Yeah. You might want to, it's funny though, because I've seen different situations, like I knew once a scenario where a retired Chicago couple, but they had come to Montana seasonally, like they summered in Montana or something for decades, loved Montana. So he finally retires and they bought a small parcel in a ranch. And I don't know if this was formalized or not. It might've just been an informal agreement. They, you know, had a great relationship with the overall ranch. But I think it might have been formalized, some recreational rights, but the wife especially was super horsey. So she got to ride, she got to gather cows, they got to help brand, but when they wanted to, and they didn't have to when they didn't want to. But so for them, it was a dream come true. They've got their 20 acres or 10 acres or whatever it was, their retirement dream home, and a whole ranch to engage with at their discretion. And again, the wife was particularly horsey, so she loved to saddle up and chase cows with the ranch crew. And I think she did that quite a bit. And you know about brandings and stuff like that. And I've been to brandings in Bozeman, outside of Bozeman, where half the participants are
drunk
urbanites. No, oh. Urbanites from Bozeman. I knew a ranch that he kind of tapped into that. Oh, he did like horsemanship and stuff. So he was getting money from people for, like, you know, training horses and stuff. And then these people would come out and brand and have that quote unquote authentic experience of branding and
Your brandings were very different than mine.
Getting yelled at by
screamed at. Those are the kicked in the face, kicked in the
those are the brandings I grew up.
Reproductive system.
Yeah, yep. I got those stories from.
There's always up. Yeah. There's always Cousin Eddie who's way too drunk by 11 o'clock. And yeah. And then he wants to do all the roping too. And he's just taking forever to catch a calf and drag it out. And someone's like, all right, the owner of these cattle needs to go tell Cousin Eddie to get off that damn horse that he's done.
I was sure my kneecaps were broken when I was about 12. I had a calf kick both my knees and I went down. I thought I was a cripple.
So here's a story. Because I'm supposed to personalize this podcast, right?
Oh, really? Is that what your team tells you?
Yep. They tell me, bring in more anecdotes, personalize it. I forget how old we were. Middle school, I would say. Mm-hmm. That's probably about the start of drinking age in Montana.
Right.
Wouldn't you say middle school?
Right. 13, 14, yeah.
So we used to have the circuit of brandings. Neighbors helping neighbors, going all over the county. Mostly the guys who had like over 200 or 300 head, they'd bring their crew and, you know, turn a long day, make it shorter. And then they would drink whiskey all through the night in a wall tent and play poker and piss off the wives and have the unlicensed children drive them home at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
But it was all county roads, so it doesn't matter.
Right.
Better than a drunk driver. Well, us middle schoolers,
unless you're sneaking beers too.
Well, I'm not sure which was the better driver. Yeah, at that point. Yeah.
Beginner's luck.
At least we still have our vision. I mean, those guys. Right. Some of them were so old and drunk they were blind. They were blind before they were drunk.
Right, right.
So we decide that, well, when no one's looking, we're gonna sneak away a few cases of a beer. Probably Bud Light at the time. I hate to say.
Yeah. That was an eon ago in marketing.
Yeah. So we take these 230 racks of Bud Light and we're like, well, damn it. We got to keep these cool somehow so that they're not just foamy and warm when the branding's over.
Right.
We need them cool so we can drink them when the branding's over and we go ride our bicycles and fish and hunt and shit too. But we threw them in the irrigation ditch and we're like, that makes perfect sense, yeah, right?
Keep cold water.
Well, the
some might not know that the water in Montana tends to be pretty frigid.
Well, and we were 2-3 miles from the mountains.
Yeah. So cold
right
water.
Out of the foothills.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Super cold water.
Yep. And yeah, the cardboard box did not last. And a few days later, his dad was out irrigating and just finds, you know, beer cans all over his, in the orange canvas dam and spread out over the field. And yeah, we got a call. They knew exactly where that beer was from.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, agricultural recreation is a thing too, getting to play cowboy. I mean, hell, you could come up with a whole Yellowstone thing. You could...
I prefer to just leave that to the individual. It's all subjective. You're limited by your imagination, your creativity, and some of the liability terms of use and risk. But when it comes to this issue, is the hardest to figure out when fractionalizing a ranch, because the reason, as we have said, 80% of the reason you buy a ranch is for recreational purposes, exclusivity.
Right.
You don't want to be out there with John Q. Public. So right. How do you, one, I'm trying to optimize for two things. One, you want people to come in at a higher investment than the minimum. So you don't want a bunch of people doing the minimum $50,000 if it's 50 or the minimum 100 or 150, whatever it is, you want people to come in a little higher. So trying to optimize for that. But then this idea of fair, equitable, egalitarian, who gets the use when? That's the hardest issue to crack. And that's what I worked on.
Who's the better shot? Who can drive better under adverse conditions?
Well, and special tag. If you have ADLPs and they've all, say most of them are out of staters and they've built up their points and they've applied for this unique tag in your area, they want to make damn sure that they have the ranch to themselves when it comes time to hunt. And so how do you manage for that great program and allocate those days as a benefit, not a right? How do you do that in a way that's also best for the investment when the manager is incentivized by optimizing returns? So you have a lot of interests there.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that's kind of what makes it interesting to me is, yeah, it's kind of a case study and looking at managing rights differently. You know, I mean, obviously we got the standard model, own outright, but we've got other things. I mean, obviously conservation easements and different, you know, unique rights situations, I guess you'd say, but yours is highly unique. And
one of my personal values is bringing more people out here, people who are invested, who have an alignment of interest with the community, the ecology. And it's about a free market solution to compete with locked gates on trophy ranches.
Right.
So a locked gate that benefits one person, one family. Let's bring more people out.
Well, actually, you know what else comes to my mind? I remember the podcast you did with Dallas, right? Who owns
Dallas Mount
Ranch and owns
Ranch Management Consultants.
Yeah, yeah. Him, because you guys were talking. I love that podcast. Actually, it's one of my favorites. And you were talking about this issue of, you know, out of state ownership and trophy ownership and like effect on culture. And he threw out, he's like, you know, some of the multi generational places are the most inefficient, worst managed.
Poorly managed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So not only the locked gate for kind of trophy kind of thing, but what about the locked gates for just the old, you know, the multi-generational that's starving to death financially and maybe even culturally, right? They're trying to hold on to this entity. I know that's part of your thing too, is how to provide value in different ways and how to monetize the resource in different ways that are creative and meet needs, you know? And that model, the old family ownership, when the other pieces aren't there to make that place thrive economically, ecologically, and otherwise, right? Maybe an alternative, like maybe an old time family place diversifying, and maybe that allowing that family to actually prosper on that place in a different way than trying to cover all the costs on their own, you know, try to run a cow outfit to pay for the place, which is almost impossible.
That's Will Harris of White Oaks Pastures. He's been on the Rogan podcast twice now.
Mm-hmm. This is the Southern guy, right?
Yep.
Georgia. Isn't he like Colonel Sanders kind of?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
He's very smooth when he talks.
Yeah. Super articulate, though, really.
Oh, incredible. And they actually, him and his daughter might be coming on this one.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
I want to join that one.
We've been in talks. She sounds like she's actually taking over. Will might be retiring.
Wow.
Might need to cut
transition
that out.
you just leaked.
Yeah. So I'll probably check on that first before we release that one. But they're gonna come back on this podcast. But Will and I disagreed about having specialists, and I still am of the mind that you should have a livestock specialist, an ecology land specialist. You know, the livestock specialist is trained in animal science, has a degree in animal science. You need finance and accounting on my family place. That's me. My brother Wyatt is the Oklahoma State grad with animal science. You need someone who's good with equipment. That's my other brother, Tig.
Right.
And then I think today you need hunting, recreation, tourism. And we say sexist things on here, but a lot of times that falls on the wife, and it's a good enterprise, you know, a well-paying enterprise.
You need a semi-expert on programs and legislation and regulation.
If you want to go down that route.
Well, I mean, don't you have to? I mean, whether you want to.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you have to compete with your neighbor, to compete with the United States. You have to take the government money and this NGOs that are out there. You're right.
But I mean, even if you don't, you know, participate in those programs, I mean, it still might affect you if you've got endangered species, or
certainly
if you got sage grouse, or I mean, it's not fully optional, isn't it, in some ways? I mean, you gotta at the very least sort of be up on some things because it can really harm you.
So Will was of the mindset that specialists, they optimize for they're siloed, they're monovariate, they're only good in some areas. You know, right. It's holistic. And I do believe in thinking and acting holistically, but I also think we should be the best at some things.
Right.
And right. So he was of the mindset, no, he's anti-specialist. I'm pro-specialist. Hmm. I do think on today's ranches, when it comes to that recreational opportunity that is being monetized, that there should be consultants in place who are thinking about, well, this is a cash cow now. So why would we not feed that cash cow?
What came up to my mind immediately was I used to turn my own wrenches. In fact, I rebuilt a car when I was 19. I used to turn all my own wrenches on my cars. But then, you know, I got kids and I'm trying to build a career, and I was trying to put a frost plug in a radiator and with antifreeze in my face and my eyes and almost stripping the threads, and 2 hours in on a job that would have taken a legit mechanic 20 minutes. That was when a switch flipped for me. Like, I'm doing more harm than good here. And of course I had that scrappy attitude and no money. So it's like, I got to do everything. But at some point you realize you're doing nothing well. And I'm actually still dealing with this in my business. Like, I think my check-in when we started was most of my time lately has been really focusing on building my team. And I'm starting to feel, you know, and there's been tasks I've struggled so mightily to get out from under, and it's not worth my time. Like, there're jobs that should be able to be farmed out. I've struggled to do that, but makes no sense for me to. And I love, you know, I love mapping. I love GIS still. I mean, part of me could just be in a silo and do GIS because I like it that much, but that's not where my time is best spent by any stretch. You know, and so it's an inefficiency at the least.
Yeah,
me doing that, but. Yeah.
Yeah. You didn't have the competitive advantage to fix your own car. Someone else with the shop downtown had all the tools, had all the training, had all the knowledge,
expertise, focus.
Yep. They had the competitive advantage. If you didn't have a job, if you were unemployed and broke, you would have the comparative advantage because your opportunity cost would be zero.
Yeah. I was going to say, because you don't have any opportunity.
Yeah. So you, in that situation, you to fix your own car, if you're jobless, you'd have the comparison.
But, you know, advantage. I do get the appeal. I got to admit, there are part of me that miss those days, because I was, you know, I was growing food. I was fixing cars. We were raising our own kids. We were freaking damn near making our own clothes. You know, that was I was part of the kind of hippie homesteader was the fantasy. Build my own house, raise my own kids, raise my own food, fix my own cars. Right. It was really captivated by self-reliance. But I remember, boy, I think having kids really started to turn that around. It's like, Jesus, where's the nanny? Where's grandma and grandpa? Where's the nanny? Where's the bookkeeper? Where's the, right? Like, for me anyway, getting older, the specialist starts to kick. And then, you know, developing a career where you start to build what's relative, incredibly high value relative to when you had no marketable skills.
I'm almost of the different mindset now that I have two girls, 2 months and 3 years old, that I'm kind of almost getting back to the point where, like, I need to take on more prepping. Like, I should go bury a storage container, get my brother's excavator out on my parents' ranch and start loading that thing for, you know, I watched Leave the World Behind on Netflix.
Yeah, I saw that too.
And now with the new movie Civil War coming out this spring, it's got me in the mindset like, hey, I need to be a little more sovereign and self-reliant. And I might move away from specials. I should maybe fix my own damn car.
Yeah, well, there's an extreme there. If, you know, and we all know specialists that, you know, can do essentially nothing else but their specialty. That's pretty anemic in my, you know what I mean? There's something about being, you know, and I don't really turn my wrenches anymore and stuff like that, but I sure can, you know, and I can change a tire, I can change my oil, I can, you know, and not being able to do those stuff would not feel good, you know, and you wonder about younger generation that seems like our culture now maybe feels like just pushing people right into that way of life rather than being broke for 10 years and having to figure everything out and do everything yourself. I mean, there's a lot of character building in that. And, well, and you know, back to the debate with, sorry, what's his name from the South?
Will Harris.
Yeah. I mean, that's, isn't that a, just a steadfast rural value of being able to do anything you need to do under any circumstances?
It's almost like a judgment of character.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
And I mean, I can attest one of my, like, identity crises of the many along the way, Andy.
Which one are we talking about? I need more context than that.
Coming from a frugal Dutch family, homesteader family, which comes with its own culture of you don't pay anyone to do anything. You do everything yourself.
Right.
The first time I paid someone to change the oil on my vehicle, I seriously, I don't know if I slept that night. I had such... Like, I don't know, I guess maybe insecurities around, am I going to be disavowed? Am I less of a man?
Right.
Am I not the, you know, the farmer, the rancher, the do it yourself, get it done, pick yourself up by your bootstraps? Cause I didn't change my damn oil. I paid somebody else.
Well, you know, you're making me think too. And you know, my career is in ranch appraisal, and I mean, Montana Land Source is, you know, more of a digital desktop kind of thing, but I take great pride in, you know, I can show up on the ranch and I can do just about anything. I mean, I didn't grow up on a ranch. I grew up, you know, peripherally, you know, like saddling a horse is a bit of a stretch for me, but I can ride, I can't rope. So there's limits, but I can help sort, I can help brand, I can change a tire, even maybe on a tractor. I mean, you know what I mean? Like that kind of.
But what about reconciling the bank statements?
Oh, I mean, Jesus.
I don't know if we call those soft skills or what, but you know, those are just as important as fixing the hydraulics on the tractor.
Yeah. You know, I mean, this is kind of a segue, but I feel like growing up in Montana. So I grew up as a city kid by Montana standards. I mean, I'm a Billings kid, right?
Yep.
But, and I don't know if I was highly unique. It didn't seem like it. It seemed like all my friends were the same way. We all were tied to ranches outside of town. We were at Brandings and went hunting and fishing. And looking back, it was kind of a great lifestyle because it was like I had foot in both worlds, you know, like, you know, all the town stuff. But, and it was a little different back then. It was easier. I mean, we still have pretty good access to open space and whatnot if we want, but things have gotten busier. Things have gotten, you know.
Does it feel like you're further from the ranch?
In my like work and career now?
Yeah, just, I mean, not geographically, not proximity, but just where your life is. Does it feel like it takes more effort, more time to get out there and do those things that you're further from that? You're like more removed, further removed from that culture, that experience?
A little bit, but yeah, our work keeps us pretty tied to that. I mean, even the ranch broker community, right, is pretty ranchy and all that kind of stuff. I do, you know, that's what I miss about writing appraisals because I haven't been writing appraisals. I've been focused on Montana Land Source, which is more of a desk duty kind of thing. So yeah, I'm at the desk and the computer a lot more. I miss the inspecting ranches and going out and finding sales. And you know, it's funny, I do more ranch tour. I jump at ranch tour opportunities now because I mean, in the past I was ranch touring all the time, right? I used to roll, you know, someone tried to get me to go to some kind of structured ranch tour and it's like, I do this every day. Like, why the hell would I do that? Now I'm like, ooh, a ranch tour. But I'm actually pretty excited because I do think I'm making headway on getting myself out of some of this work that's desk related. And I do want to go out and inspect the ranches that are on the market and, you know, call you up and say, hey, take me, what do you think about taking me to your next listing? I'll do some content and, you know, that kind of thing.
I think you should
get a little back to the land.
It's almost like bringing an anecdotal experience because you're all data driven.
Right.
And you're now it's data also needs to be balanced with anecdotes. So if you show up, what you see in person on foot is completely different than what you see from Google Earth and being advertised in the brochure.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think you should do more.
I'm excited for that. And even not even just the ranch itself, but even more networking opportunities. Like I went to the last day of the stock growers, you know, at the Northern and was, I don't know why I was surprised, but how many people I knew there and how many, I mean, clients, but also, you know, customer clients, but also just, you know, it's even though our population has really swelled and things are changing, it's still a small world, you know, especially here. We still have that.
Very. So, Montana's, by and large, still just one long main street.
I saw, I think, an ad or something or a post for a winter fair popped up, you know, in Lewistown. And I got a little, oh, I should go to, you know, I've done that in years past and had a good time. And
yeah.
Stuff like that. Get out in the country more.
Yeah. Especially as Western Montana becomes much more distant from Eastern Montana.
Right. Right. Yeah. So, no, I think this industry, thankfully, even when I spend a god-awful amount of time, you know, at the computer, still, even just the people I talk to on the phone and the meetings I go to and that kind of stuff keeps me a bit connected, you know. And I still am out on the road. I still do go look at stuff, you know, and travel.
Well, I encourage anyone to check out Montana Land Source. You have awesome updates, statistics. Yeah,
appreciate that.
Keep checking in, seeing where this market's going as we enter the Christmas break of 2023. Let's see what the new year has to offer us. Any final thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's going to be calm for a while. I think we're in the calm after the storm, you know, and that's just the way it's going to be.
Other than the trophy ranches.
Yeah. But if you got a trophy ranch, it's just going to fly off the shelves, apparently.
We'll see what happens. These interest rates are certainly throwing a wrench in a lot of brokers' business,
which always surprises me. I mean, with the level of cash buying, you would think that the high level land market in Montana would be insulated from that because there's very few finance based purchasing. But
we're not talking about debt and leverage. We're talking about opportunity cost.
Right. Right. Yeah. But it fascinates me because again, a tertiary view, you could easily say, oh, interest, what would interest rates have to do with ranches in Montana, which are almost always bought with cash?
Yeah. Well, I mean, when CD rates are 3%, you'd rather have fun with your money.
Yeah.
You don't want it in a CD at 3%, but when they're up at 5.5 and 6, then a fun little ranch, you know, you have to have those tough conversations with your wife.
Right.
Well, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks. Good to be back.
Anyone who has feedback, comments, questions, be sure to reach out to me or Andy, Montana Land Source and Ranch Investor. Thanks for tuning in. We at Ranch Investor are very interested in hearing your thoughts, your opinion, your wants, desires, hopes, and dreams, everything on ranch syndications, ranch investment, ranch real estate syndications, and DPPs, direct participation programs. Please reach out.
Click subscribe on your streaming platform so you know when the latest episode has dropped. Be the source of knowledge and the maven that other professionals are excited to refer.